For our final session, I want to look at an example of everything we're talking about in action, and not everything we're talking about, but what does it mean to speak the truth in love? What does it mean to have compassion without compromise? And I'm going to call this convictional compassion. And what I mean in all of this is I want to make sure that you keep in mind that it's one thing to take a stand for what you believe online or to post things or forward emails or do whatever. It's a whole other thing to interact with people as people and have a dialogue with them about your beliefs. And I just want to tell you that that is always going to be the greater impact, okay? Getting to know someone who thinks different than you, that has different morals than you, who has a different religious view, whether it's going to be a roommate one day or a relative or a friend or a coworker, talking to someone one-on-one is really important, but it's a skill that you got to be careful. At the end of our last session, Ian was reminding all of us that Jesus is described in John 1 as he came full of grace and truth. Full of grace and truth. So my attitude in general is usually truth to the issue, grace to the person. That whatever the issues we're talking about, I want to hold up God's truth and address it that way, but I always want to have grace towards this person. And it's based on partly from Colossians 4, verses 5 and 6, where it says, walk in wisdom toward outsiders, talking about non-believers. Be wise when you're talking to unbelievers. Making the best use of the time. Some versions say, making the most of every opportunity that God gives you. You've got this roommate, this waiter or waitress right now, this neighbor, this whatever. You make the most of that. God's put them in your life for a reason. Long term, short term, whatever it is. And then it says this, let your speech always be gracious, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how you ought to answer each person. So, as I'm speaking, I always have gracious words. Seasoned with salt. Salt was a preservative. Obviously, in Jesus' day, they didn't have refrigerators. And so they would use it to preserve things. So my speech should have that effect, or I'm helping to stop the spread of decay, maybe. But salt also adds flavor. That's another way to think of it. Salt also creates thirst. That maybe how I'm living or what I'm saying can make someone be like, I want that, or that's not what I have. I wish that I had your hope, or I wish that I had whatever it is, but my speech is gracious, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how you ought to answer each person. One of the things in our breakout groups we just talked about was the issue of racism, and we said how there's literally no more shallow way than to judge someone based solely on external stuff. Like, that's the shallowest you can ever get. But for me to meet someone and immediately go like, oh, I know what you need, and I'm just going to tell you the truth, is also pretty shallow. This says, so that you may know how you ought to answer each person. How do you know that? You get to know them. You ask them questions. The percentage of times that Jesus was asked a question versus the number of times Jesus answered questions is interesting to look at. But what's really fascinating is there's only like 8 times when Jesus actually directly answered a question. He would ask a question in return. Or, well, what do you think? Why? Because he wanted a dialogue. He wanted this person to know, like, I see you, and I'm interested in getting to know you, and for me to make sure that you know that I care about you as an individual. And the best example of this is going to be Jesus talking with the woman at the well in John 4. A lot of people don't know this. This is the longest recorded dialogue of Jesus anywhere. Right before, the chapter before it is the second longest. It's Nicodemus. But here's what's interesting. At the end of his book, John said, I could have written about so many things about Jesus. There are so many stuff. It would have filled all the books. It was amazing. But these things that I picked to be in my book are so that you might believe. So in other words, John purposely looked at all of these stories and he said, I want to include that one. Oh, I got to make sure I include that one. And he put these stories in there for a reason. So Jesus meeting with a Samaritan woman, the woman at the well in John 4, was chosen by John as a really important story. Now, here's the other thing that's interesting. John 3 is Jesus meeting with a religious, male, upstanding person, and he tells him, you need to be rescued. John 4 is Jesus meeting with a female, Samaritan, non-different religious, immoral person. He tells her that you need rescue. We're the ones, just so you know, about 700 years ago, we added in all the different chapters and divisions and verses and stuff, which isn't bad. It's just what we did. We added them in there, which means when John wrote his book, John 3 and John 4 were just one train of thought. I'm just going to include this next story, okay? So Jesus' point here was, or John's point, including these, was that it doesn't matter if you are super religious and you're living really well, or you're irreligious and you're living immorally, it's still the message of hope that you need from Jesus. But this story is interesting because it took place in Samaria, which is where in Jesus' day, people didn't go through Samaria, but Jesus purposely went through Samaria because of the issue of, we would call it today, racism. I would say it's more ethnocentrism, that the Jews thought, we're God's kingdom, we're God's people, we're the chosen people, these Samaritans are half-breeds. So it's this still issue of racism, ethnic tension that's going on that Jesus was addressing even here. Okay? So look with me in John 4, verse 1. Now when Jesus learned that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus was making and baptizing more disciples than John, although Jesus himself did not baptize, but only his disciples, he left Judea and departed again for Galilee, and he had to pass through Samaria. Now, again, that's important because a good Jew would go around Samaria because you don't want to deal with those people because of the way they were viewed. So he came to a town of Samaria called Sychar near the field that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, so Jesus, wearied as he was from his journey, was sitting beside the well. It was about the sixth hour, so it's about noontime. A woman from Samaria came to draw water. Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink," for his disciples had gone into the city to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, "How is it that you, a Jew, ask for a drink from me, a woman of Samaria?" For Jews had no dealings with Samaritans. Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that is saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." The woman said to him, "Sir, you have nothing to draw water with, and the well is deep. Where do you get that living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob? He gave us the well and drank from it himself, as did his sons and his livestock." Jesus said to her, "Everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never be thirsty again. The water that I will give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life." The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I will not be thirsty or have to come here to draw water." So she misunderstood what he was talking about, right? But Jesus decides he's going to take kind of a natural illustration right in front of them and draw it over to a spiritual thing. You're thirsty here. Guess what? You're going to get thirsty again. You're going to have to come back maybe tomorrow. I've got something that I can offer you that has eternal satisfaction. In fact, it's going to give you eternal life. So the conversation continues. Jesus said to her, "Go, call your husband and your husband and come here." The woman answered him, "I have no husband." Jesus said to her, "You are right in saying, 'I have no husband,' for you have had five husbands, and the one you now have is not your husband. What you have said is true." The woman said to him, "Sir, I perceive that you're a prophet. Our fathers worshiped on this mountain, but you say that in Jerusalem is the place where people ought to worship." Notice how she changed the subject, by the way, real quick. All of a sudden, he's prying into her personal life, and now she wants to talk about a mountain, right? Anyways, she's trying to get back to this issue that she thinks should be dividing them about your people versus my people. And I'll tell you why they said that in just a minute. Jesus said to her, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews." That's where it originated from. "But the hour is coming and is now here when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For the Father is seeking such people to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth." The woman said to him, "I know that Messiah is coming, he who is called Christ. When he comes, he will tell us all things." Jesus said to her, "I who speak to you am he." It's interesting. That's actually the very first time that Jesus openly revealed himself as the Messiah to someone. And he chose to reveal it to a woman who was a foreigner, who wasn't of the Jewish faith, who wasn't living a moral life. And he decided, "You're going to be the one that I tell this amazing news." There's other times when he kind of avoided the issue or said, "Don't tell anyone." Here he says, "I want you to know this." So What was at the heart of this? I'll just go ahead and tell you when it comes to Jews versus Samaritans. This really was a big deal in Jesus' day. When you hear the story of the Good Samaritan, you think of it as a story about one person being nice to someone who's in need. That's true. How we love on people isn't qualified by anything. It's supposed to be that way. But when you understand the tension that was going on between Jews and Samaritans, and Jesus, to a Jewish audience, made the Samaritan the hero of the story, that was flying right in the face of their ethnocentric view of themselves. We don't think of it that way, but that's exactly what Jesus was trying to demolish. Jesus was called a Samaritan as a slur. It's a racial slur to be called a Samaritan. So this tension that's going on here is something that really started in the Old Testament. I was going to tell you, you had Israel that was one big kingdom, and then they divided into another northern and southern kingdom because of David's grandson, and the northern kingdom turned really bad. They had no godly kings, and the northern kingdom said, well, we got to make our own capital, and they chose Samaria to be their capital, okay? So Samaria was originally just a city. It wasn't an area, and there was tension between the northern and southern kingdoms in a lot of instances, but prophets were sent to both north and south there. The northern kingdom, because they had no godly kings, went downhill faster. They were destroyed by the Assyrians, 722 BC. Southern kingdom, about half of the kings were godly. They also had prophets warning them. Theirs took a little bit longer. Finally, in 586 BC, they were conquered by the Babylonians. But when that conquering happened with both of them, people were displaced. The Babylonians took the southern kingdom kind of off into captivity, and you get the stories of Daniel and Esther and stuff. Then later they come back, right? The stories of Ezra and Nehemiah. Well, when they come back, the land is now kind of not fully made up of just Jews. You've got this mixture of people that have been brought in as foreigners and other people that are kind of mixing with them, and there begin to be this racial tension, and there is a group of people that begin to be called Samaritans. They were from that area where people had mixed racial Jews and either these pagans who had been brought in by the Assyrians or other people. They begin to intermarry with them, and they were kind of their own ethnicity. They were viewed as half-breeds by a lot of people. And there began to be, even before Jesus' time, there was different times when the Samaritans would kind of align themselves with the Jews, with Israel, if it was favorable for them, or they'd be against them. There was a time when some Samaritans snuck down into Jerusalem, into the temple, and scattered bones in the temple, kind of desecrated the temple. There's a time when Israel, Jews, went up to Samaria, to their temple, and they destroyed the temple in Samaria. There's all these tensions that were going on. Okay, it's racial history that Jesus is now in the middle of. And so if you're a good Jew, you do not go into that land. You don't go through that area. You definitely don't make him the hero of your story, right? That's what's going on in this when Jesus is meeting with a Samaritan woman. And actually, if you read it, if you look in the next verse, just then his disciples came back. They marveled that he was talking with a woman, but no one said, "What do you seek?" So Jesus was breaking down a few different barriers. And by the way, where they're at, Mount Gerizim is, well, you can't even read it on there, but that's where they had their own temple. So when Jesus is talking to this woman and she goes, well, you guys say you should worship in Jerusalem. We worship on this mountain. This is what she's referring to. You guys established your temple. We had our temple, which you destroyed. And now you guys think, and that's kind of the conversation that's going on here. But here's what's interesting. Jesus, in just talking to this woman, broke down some of these man-made barriers of culture, ethnicity, gender, and morality. That you've got the Jewish culture, the way they wanted to do things, and you've got the Samaritan culture. You've got the Jewish ethnicity and the Samaritan ethnicity. You've got a man versus a woman. Back in this day, men and women didn't have these out-in-public conversations like this. That's why the disciples were amazed that he was talking to a woman, and she's a Samaritan woman. Jews and Gentiles, that even John is saying here, in case you didn't know the story, they don't have anything to do with each other. So Jesus is here as a rabbi, male Jewish religious man, talking to a female Samaritan, different religious views, immoral woman. So all of these categories that people would say, that should keep you away from her, Jesus, is exactly what Jesus goes in and says, this is why we need to have this conversation. I'm not going to ignore you because of how you're living, because of what your ethnicity is, because of what your background is, whatever it is, I'm not going to allow that to stop this message of the gospel. Okay? So let me just observe for us five applications from this. Actually, six applications. This is the way my brain works. Chris knows this long enough after working with me. They're all letter C. It's a letter C. Okay? I can't get away from it. It's just, it flows. I'm like, oh, there's another C. So this is how we can apply this to us. And if we're going to live out Colossians 4, 5, and 6. The first one is courage. Now, it's easy for me to go, well, Jesus probably didn't take much courage because he's Jesus. But the model that you see here is that Jesus took the initiative to start this conversation, that he didn't let these barriers stop him from talking, okay? That was irrelevant compared to the truth that he wanted to share, right? We're speaking the truth in love. The application for us is, I need to have the courage to say, like, because again, my attitude might be like, well, I'll sit around and wait for them, for a lost person to come to me and say, what must I do to be saved? Like, when is that ever going to happen? Right? So I need to be the one to have the courage to say, hey, can I share something with you? Can I pray for you? Yeah, can I invite you to church? Like, you need to have the courage to be able to cross over that man-made barrier and just go, I love you enough that I'm going to go ahead and tell you the truth. I'm not going to let that stop us. Okay? The second thing you see is connection. Jesus purposely used the idea of water and thirst and need to tie it into a spiritual thing. So you want to be able to try to have a connection with someone and maybe get to know them and talk or things like that. I've shared with some of you before, if my wife and I are on a date, a lot of times we'll just ask the waiter or waitress just questions about them. Where are you from and what are you doing and stuff? And then before we eat our food, we're just like, well, is there anything we can pray for you about? We're about to pray for our food. Like, is there any way that I can make a connection with them? Or like, oh, we're from there too. Or like, oh yeah, my daughter goes to that school. Or what? Like, I'm trying to make a connection so that they know that I see you as a person. And then I'm trying to make a spiritual connection as well. And how I can tie that in some other way. Now again, I don't want to do it in a corny way. Like, oh gee, it's hot outside. Yeah, it sure is. Well, you know what else is hot? Hell is really hot. So you should, like, I don't need to do that, right? But I'm trying to, Jesus is making a connection here. He's using something to say, let's make this conversation about something that actually really matters, which also takes courage. Guys especially, we're really good at just kind of staying in the shallow end, talking about sports and weather and cars and stuff like that. We need to go a little deeper and be willing to say, all right, let's talk about stuff that's a little deeper. The next one, okay, this is where I'm kind of stretching to get another C. Ceaseless life. This is all I could come up with. I looked up all these synonyms for eternity or eternal or life or whatever. Eternal life. Jesus finally comes down and says, I'm going to talk about this issue, that you need something that I only can offer you, and it's really important, that it's going to satisfy you, and it's what you ultimately need more than just physical water, and it's salvation. That's what this woman really, really needed, okay? And so ultimately, I can love people, I can invite people, I can hang out with people, I can make connections with people, but eventually, you guys, I got to land the plane and tell them about Jesus. I really do. If I actually believe that I have something that they need. And that's, for some of us, you might not believe that. It might not, maybe it hasn't changed you enough yet or transformed you enough yet where you realize, like, no, this is really my only hope. But at some point, I've just got to go, let me just cut to the chase and just tell you, man, Jesus has changed my life. Let me just tell you why we need Jesus. Let me just tell you, and you've got to talk about that issue, okay? The next three aren't as stretching is that one. Compassion. We had read there in Colossians about having our words be gracious or seasoned with salt, all those things. The word compassion actually means to suffer with. It's to recognize, like, I'm going to come alongside you and I'm going to see you where you're at. It's really easy to just look at people, especially if they're blatantly living in sin, to just to condemn and just go, that's wrong, you should stop doing that, and just deal with the symptoms and not the real issue. But for me to remember, lost people are acting like lost people because they're lost people. That's what their real issue is. They need a new heart. That's why they're bitter or prideful or angry or sleeping around or finding their identity in looks or things or porn or whatever it is. Like, I need to go, listen, where would I be without Jesus? What would I be chasing? What would my identity be in? Like, what shallow, like, non-eternal, unimportant stuff would I think is just the most important stuff in the world? I need to have compassion and just go, but for the grace of God, that's exactly where I would be. So Jesus doesn't just stand over there and condemn this woman like, now you know you shouldn't be sleeping with this guy who's not your husband. Like, she knew that. She was aware of that. So he was brave enough to bring it up, but then he didn't just camp on that and say, so that's your real issue. You need to get married. You need to stop sleeping. That's not her real issue. Okay? So he had compassion on her and where she was. And then he actually offers correction. This is important. He does, in this conversation, gently say, you guys are talking about something that you think you know about. We're actually the people that God has chosen. So he's okay with correcting her. Don't be afraid of telling someone, like, that's actually sin. This is super offensive today, you guys, to most people, that even you would call something sin. But to let people know, like, the truth is, we're not all good. We're not all God's children. We're not naturally selfless. We're all actually pretty bad off. And again, I'm right there with you. But being able to correct someone's views and just to go, you know, actually, I disagree. People don't all find God their own way. What matters is if you find God God's way. That's what matters. No, actually, there is a difference between men and women, like scientifically, but also the way God created us. Yeah, I know that Christianity has been used to kind of abuse and mistreat and stuff. That's actually not true Christianity. Let me correct you on that thinking. Like, it's okay to do that if you're speaking the truth in love, right? So it's important that I'm not spineless, but I'm not heartless in this, okay? And then the last one, Christ. Again, we're getting it, bringing it all the way back to Jesus. Jesus was talking about, you know, living water, eternal water and stuff. And what he lands on is the one who's going to restore all things, who's going to make all things right. It's me. I, who am speaking to you, the one that you're looking at right now, I'm that Messiah. She believed that at least. Like, well, we know, at least we believe that Christ, Messiah, when he comes, he's going to, and Jesus goes, that's going to be the ultimate solution. Okay? That's ultimately what you need. You don't need to turn over a new leaf. You don't need to try harder to be better. You don't need to get more religious. You need Jesus. You need a new heart. That's ultimately what you need. So it's me loving someone enough to say, it would be unloving for me not to tell you this, to let you go on blindly in your sin thinking that you're fine. Like, that's the most unloving thing I can do, right? If I'm a doctor and I'm like, this person has cancer, like, but man, this news would ruin their day. It would be totally unloving for me to not tell them, right? Because I don't want them to be mad at me. It's like, but do you love them, though? So it's the same way in all of this. There's all these barriers and excuses we come up with. Jesus just jumps over all of those things, and he's like, I'm just going to go. I'm looking for people like this. So we mentioned praying for discernment earlier today. I would challenge you, are you praying for interactions with people who are different than you? Because we don't naturally want that. I naturally want interactions that are comfortable and safe with people like me that make me feel good and encourage me, and there's no disagreement. That's what I just want in my flesh. And in all my relationships, in my marriage, with my kids, like, that's what I naturally want. Sharing the truth with someone that they're actually under God's wrath because of their sin is not fun. But do I love them enough to say, I'm going to talk to you about this because you might be mad at me now, but I'm telling you something that if you really understand it, you will be so grateful that your eyes were opened. Does that make sense? So, I love this reminder from what we've been studying in 1 Peter even. Jesus is basically saying the kingdom that I'm bringing is radically different from what you think to all of his people. That in the Old Testament, Exodus 19, God says, I'm going to set you apart among all peoples, all the others, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. He's telling his people, I'm going to do this inclusive move with you guys, just in bringing you in so that you can now go out and include the whole world. Like, you're my mouthpiece for the world. So it's this initially exclusive move for an inclusive message to all people. And so Israel is to be separate from the world, to be a witness to the world. That's why God is asking you to be separate, not to form this holy huddle, not so that you never come across anybody who's not a Christian. That's not why he's telling you that. He's saying, I want you to be separate from the world, so you can be this message to the world, where you look different from the world, where the world is going like, I don't understand it, I don't even know if I'm going to change my mind, but you're definitely different. And again, we don't actually want that. We want to fit in and be liked and things like that. But am I living in such a way where the world goes, you got something that I don't have? This is the verse in 1 Peter where Peter draws on the exact same idea of what God said to his people in the Old Testament. And he says, but you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession. That, which means there's a purpose for this, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his glorious light. So why does God give me this blessing to be this priesthood for him? That I go out and I tell the world this truth, that I take a stand, that I shine as a light into this world. Okay? That's the message there. So when you read in Colossians 4, now hopefully with new eyes, this is what Jesus did. He walked in wisdom towards this woman. That he made the best use of this opportunity, that his speech was gracious. It was full of salt, which salt stings sometimes, right? That's what salt does, but it also can heal. And then he was looking at her as an individual, that I want to answer you and where you're at. I see you as a woman. I see you as someone who's valuable, not just the way the world would see you. So I love this quote from C.T. Studd, who is, first of all, has a cool name. But he's a missionary to China and India and Africa. He says, let us not glide through this world and then slip quietly into heaven without having blown the trumpet loud and long for our Redeemer, Jesus Christ. Let us see to it that the devil will hold a Thanksgiving service in hell when he gets the news of our departure from the field of battle. Like, I'm doing so much damage for the kingdom that Satan is actually glad when I finally die. Like, let's throw a party, you guys. He was doing so much damage for the kingdom of God. Would people say that about you, or is Satan excited about how you're living your life? Like, oh, they're helping my cause plenty. I had a summer staffer years ago write this in her journal, and then she shared it with a bunch of us one time, and I said, can I use that quote? Can I use this way of thinking? And here's what she was thinking about her summer ministry, where she was about to run for 13 weeks really, really hard. But she said this, exploit every second for the cause of the great King, because of the joy set before you, the joy of knowing that you've honored him well. Don't forget that now is the time for reckless running, because there is coming a day when you will see him in all his glory and wish for one more crown to lay at his feet. Run hard now. One day you don't have to run anymore. One day the race is over. But for now, we run hard. I exploit every moment for the cause of the great King. That's what I want to be known for. Just give me one more chance to tell somebody about Jesus. That should be my attitude. I'm making the best use of the time. I'm seeing people the way God sees them, right? So convictional compassion.